Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Money Talking from WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman. One of the things about reporting on the economy is that you can always find a cloud for every silver lining. Case in point, the U.S. dollar. Right now, it's really strong. A dollar will get you about 1 euro. So if you're lucky enough to be heading off to Paris or Rome, well, it might not be a steal, but that cup of espresso is sure going to be a lot more affordable. So all of this is a good thing, right? Wrong. There's a concern that some of the nation's biggest companies will get hurt doing business overseas, and that in turn will undermine confidence and could lead CEOs to slow down investments, maybe hire fewer people, and that in turn could slow down future U.S. growth. With me to consider both sides of the coin are Josh Barrow of the New York Times and Rana Fruhar with Time Magazine. And Rana, which is it? Strong dollar good, strong dollar bad?
Well, you know, strong dollar bad right now, I'm going to have to say. And you can already see it. Corporate earnings, which were, you know, at record highs to begin with last year, have been decreasing. And there's concern that that's going to go further. And if you look historically, all five recessions of corporate earnings in the U.S. have been preceded by a period of a stronger dollar because, you know, it really hurts exports of big American companies.
Josh, what do you think?
Well, I think whether you want a strong dollar depends on the circumstance. I think there are two factors that are driving up the dollar right now. One is that the economic outlook is much stronger in the U.S. than it is in other advanced countries. So the strong dollar there is more a symptom of our relatively good economy than a cause of particular economic outcomes. But then a strong dollar is also driven by policy. We have the Federal Reserve looking like it's about to start raising interest rates pretty soon. So we're probably going to have a tighter monetary policy than places like Europe and Japan over the next few years, which will cause the dollar to appreciate relatively. That may not be a good thing for the economy right now because we don't really have a strong economic liftoff right now. Those rate increases will slow the economy. And the other thing is, it's not just about corporate investment. A strong dollar makes exports from U.S. companies more expensive for people in other countries to buy. So it reduces employment here in the U.S.
Right. I think you've actually raised an important point. The economy itself, the real economy in the U.S. is pretty weak. The markets have been high, but that is because the Federal Reserve had this unprecedented program of quantitative easing and the rates have been low for so long. I actually think this bifurcation between the U.S. and Europe right now, the fact that we've got a really strong dollar, but the Fed's pulling back, the euro's weaker, the ECB is starting to pump money into the system, really reflects that central bankers are controlling everything in the economy.
They're the last game in town.
They're the only game in town.
But is there any benefit for consumers that the dollar is so strong? Is there any benefit that they might be spending more and that could get the economy going again? I mean, if we're talking about governments, we're talking about corporations, what about the consumer?
I think you summed it up. If you're headed to Paris, great. But the problem is all this is happening at the same time when you have deflation as well. And that's not just in goods, but in wages. You still got very flat wages, only about 2% wage growth. That affects people much more than being able to get a gadget a little bit more cheaply.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just if you're going to Paris. If you're buying imported goods, oil being the most important one, then, you know, the strengthening of the dollar and the related decline in oil prices
is a good thing.
It has been a good thing for you. But on the other hand, if you work in an exporting industry or in an industry that supports an exporting industry,
or in an oil industry,
it's not been good for you.
Well, another topic that's getting a lot of attention right now is television. This weekend, Game of Thrones is starting its new season. Mad Men is in the middle of its final season. And while the content is getting a lot of people talking, there's a lot that's actually going on with how we get our favorite shows. There's services like Netflix and Hulu. There's Sling that's been just launched by Dish. HBO has a new service. Are we witnessing the end of the dominance of cable television?
Well, you know, I watched the season opener of Mad Men this past Sunday, and I have to say, commercials, so over them. You know, I have thought for some time, and Frank, I've been writing this story for 10 years, that yes, the era of totally digital on-demand TV is here.
Just around the corner.
It's just around the corner. I think it really is. I mean, if you look statistically, every year the figures of cable subscribers go down. Millennials simply do not watch television this way. The trend line is all pointing in this direction.
Yeah, I don't. I sort of feel like with Rana, it seems like this has to happen eventually. But on the other hand, we've been saying for an awfully long time that it was about to happen. You still have about 90% of U.S. households paying for cable or satellite. I feel like if you're a young media professional in New York, you know a lot of people who could afford cable but don't have it. But those people are actually really weird when you look at it
in terms of how they're getting their video.
Right. And so the market for this stuff is still fairly limited. Now, eventually, it seems like the cable technology is outdated. There shouldn't be this distinction between which box is your television and which box is your computer. It should all just be content coming in somewhere. But I think people have gotten burned over and over again saying that that change was just about to happen. The other thing is I think people are really excited about the unbundling of content because they misunderstand the economics of content. They feel like, well, I pay for 80 channels and I only watch three of them.
If I can
pay
for AMC.
Right. If I can pay for just those three, I'd save so much money. But the thing is, all the other cable subscribers also only watch three channels. If you paid for only your little pieces of the bundle, the content would cost the same amount to produce. The cost per channel would just end up going up.
It's a really interesting point, though. I totally agree with that. But also, you know, as the Chinese would say, danger and opportunity here for content creators, because it also exposes what people really do want to watch and what they don't.
And I think if you have an audience of three people who are watching, great animals of the Midwest or something.
Hey, I'm from Indiana. Don't bash animals in the West. But I think it's going to create some really interesting new business models in terms of content creation. And I think ultimately, I believe firmly, people are going to buy specific pieces of content, shows, properties, programs that are tied to individuals as opposed to buying a network. I mean, we love Mad Men. AMC, eh.
Yeah. I meant to say great invertebrates of the Midwest.
Although it feels like a lot of the new entrants are also bundles. I mean, Netflix is a bundle. You pay $8 a month for a zillion movies you're never going to watch and a number of original series. We've moved away from iTunes, where you pay by the song, toward use of things like Spotify, where you again pay a subscription fee for a bundle of music, most of which you're never going to listen to. So I think it's possible that we're going to see a big revolution in the payment model while still retaining the bundle approach.
Well, in the little bit of time that we have left, what are some of the other stories you're watching? Josh?
I've been watching marijuana taxes and how disappointed people are with they're not as high as they were expecting them to be. Colorado, the numbers are coming in about 40% below projections. And this is a story you're likely to see over and over again in other states. The market's just not that big, and it's surprisingly difficult to get people into the legal market once you legalize. You still get black market sales. And so states, you know, there are a lot of reasons to legalize marijuana. The big revenue numbers that some people like to talk about is probably not one of the reasons.
Rana?
I was interested in the press conference this week between Vladimir Putin and the Greek prime minister. Putin is really courting Greece. Greece is showing a little love to Russia, as are some of the far-right parties in Hungary and France. It's interesting that at a time when Europe is weakening, Russia seems to be trying to flex its muscle.
Well, Josh Barrow with The New York Times and Rana Fruhar with Time Magazine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Charlie Herman, and this is Money Talking from WNYC.